Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off today. The school year is, of course, well underway, and this hour we thought we'd take a look at two questions being hotly debated among educators. First, should middle and high schools push start times back a half hour or an hour? Experts say there are real health and safety benefits for teens, and classroom performance can improve as well. But making the switch to a later bell is easier said than done. We'll talk about this in just a bit. The second question involves the school cafeteria. A few years back, the Obama administration overhauled school lunch requirements to up the nutritional factor and to make healthful choices like apples and grapes, green beans and milk more appealing. The Trump presidency is loosening some of the newer rules, so we're asking, how have the changes affected school children? Are they eating more fruits and vegetables? Is this translating into better work in the classroom? And do poor students consistently have access to good, nutritious lunches at school? As always, we welcome your questions and comments. 888-477-9499 is the number to call. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Joining us now to offer some insight is Marlene Schwartz, director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at the University of Connecticut. Welcome to Radio Times, Marlene.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So let's first take a look at the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act, which was signed into law nearly 7 years ago by then-President Obama. One of the missions of this act was to allow the USDA to make some real reforms to school lunches and breakfasts. Marlene, what was wrong with some or even much of the food being offered to students at the time?
Well, I think that there had always been regulations about the nutrition of the school lunch, but what had happened was the food industry and sort of the demand of children to have meals at school similar to what they might get at a fast food restaurant or a food court at a mall had really led to some deterioration in the nutrition quality of what was actually there. So even though they were technically following the rules, you had lots of things like chicken nuggets and french fries and pizza and hamburgers, and there really just wasn't as much fruits and vegetables, and there had been an increase in serving size so that the calorie maximums had gotten quite high. So what the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act did were a couple of major things. One is it set calorie maximums for the very first time instead of just having calorie minimums, which had always been there. And it also required much more diversity in terms of the fruits and vegetables that were offered. So, for example, offering potato products each day wouldn't be acceptable anymore.
So flash forward 6 years. I read this in a recent New York Times article. School districts in California have taken over farms and are growing enough tomatoes to make their own pizza sauce. Alaska pollock is being paired with grits in Greenville, South Carolina. And in Waynesboro, Georgia, local grain is being milled into flour for whole wheat baked goods. So, Marlene, is this indicative of what is now happening in many schools across the country? If I were to walk into a public school cafeteria after I wrapped up the show today, what would I see?
It would really depend on where you were. There's huge diversity across the country in terms of how progressive or innovative the districts have been. I mean, you're guaranteed that they are following the law. I think that 99% of the school districts out there have managed to update and change their menus so that they're compliant with the federal regulation. So you would definitely see more whole grains, more fruits and vegetables, lower fat proteins, lower fat dairy products. So that, I think, is everywhere. But these super innovative things of connecting with local farmers or, you know, school gardens and things like that, I think you definitely will see more of them, but they're not, I don't think, universal yet.
So if we're seeing more fruits and vegetables, what do the efforts look like to make fruits and vegetables more appealing to kids?
Well, first of all, is just having more diversity. So having, you know, not just like corn and potatoes, for example, but really trying to have green leafy vegetables, you know, orange and yellow vegetables, and trying to mix it up more, trying to offer students more options each day because they are required to take either a fruit or a vegetable. So trying to make sure that they have a few choices there. And that, I think, has led to more demand for produce in the school lunch program, which hopefully is affecting the industry as a whole.
So students have reacted positively to the changes?
I think that there have been diverse reactions. I think in the beginning, change is always hard, and there was quite a bit of complaining. And I think students were used to, you know, the lunch looking a certain way. And when they came in one September and it didn't look the same way, there were definitely some students that were not happy about that. But I think that everybody has gotten used to it. And interestingly, the food industry has responded by reformulating a lot of the products, like pizza, for example, or pasta, so that the products are now compliant, and yet they still are familiar types of foods. And so overall, I think that most students now are quite happy with the school lunch.
So, Marlene, let's get to the Trump administration reworking of some of the Obama rules. Number one, whole grain. What's changing here?
Well, there were fairly strict whole grain requirements, and they were kind of progressive in terms of the proportion of each product that needed to be whole grain and the proportion of the products in your whole repertoire that needed to be whole grain. So I think that because the food service directors had to wait for the industry to catch up, because you can't serve a product that you can't buy, I think there was some frustration there early on. But my understanding is that the industry really has caught up, and most of the products that people need are readily available. So I think the idea, there had been some hope of loosening up those rules, but honestly, I don't think it really matters at this point, because I think the food service directors have already ordered the food for this school year that's already been made by the companies. And so my guess is that that won't really have much impact.
Okay, number two, milk, plain milk versus flavored milk.
Yeah, so milk, flavored milk has always been sort of a hot button issue. There have been districts that have taken it out. There have been districts that have taken it out and put it back in. The difference with the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act was that if you wanted to have flavored milk, it needed to be fat free or skim milk. And then plain milk could be 1% or fat free. So the change that was made by the USDA recently was that you could also have 1% flavored milk. So whether that's going to make a big difference, whether somehow students are, you know, going to flock to drinking milk because 1% flavored is now available, whereas before it was only fat-free, frankly, I'd be surprised if this made any difference at all. I've also read that a lot of the milk companies stopped making 1% flavored milk to package for schools because it couldn't be sold there. So, again, it's not that easy to just turn these things around on a dime. These are big industries.
Sure.
And so I don't think it's going to matter. I think we'll still have a couple of types of white milk and the fat-free flavored milk in most schools.
You know, the Red Center has found actually the kids are adjusting to plain milk in many circumstances, unless, of course, you add fruit juice to the mix, then all bets are off.
Exactly. So we did a study in a school district in Connecticut that had actually removed flavored milk entirely, and there was a lot of worry that the kids would refuse to drink the white milk. And so we collected data over a couple of years and found that immediately after the flavored milk was removed, there definitely was a drop in milk consumption. But if you waited a couple years and went back in, you saw that there was a significant increase. So kids really do get used to change, not to mention that as kids come into the school system, whatever is there is their new normal. And so they were drinking white milk. The juice finding was sort of interesting because 100% fruit juice is still permitted with the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act, although it is only supposed to be there for half of the times as a fruit option. So it is somewhat limited. But what we found was that the days when juice was available, milk consumption dropped. So kids still do, some of them anyway, prefer fruit juice to milk.
And finally, salt. Schools will not have to lower the sodium content of meals that are served until 2020. And under the Obama rules, that was not the case.
Right. So reducing sodium in the food supply has been a major effort, not just in the school systems, but in the food industry overall due to health concerns. And so there were some fairly strict and quick expectations for the food services to start decreasing sodium. And again, this was more just sort of slowing things down. It's not really going backwards. It's just not pushing things forward as quickly. And again, I feel like it has to do with the reformulation, that as the companies can make lower sodium formulations of the products that they sell to schools, it'll be much easier for the schools to then serve those products to students.
So Marlene Schwartz, overall, how would you characterize these changes coming from the Trump administration? Are they a huge deal?
I don't think so. I think that the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act was a huge deal. And in addition to all of the wonderful changes to the school meals, it also started regulating all of the competitive and snack foods that are sold that alongside the meals and vending machines, school stores and things like that. So there's no question that if you walk into a school cafeteria today compared to, you know, 7 years ago, it's going to look much, much better. These changes, I think, are sort of trying to make it a little bit easier for the food service directors who are having trouble sourcing products that meet the standards, so it loosens it up a little bit, but I don't really see this as a step backwards.
How has the effect of the Obama-era rules, how have these rules affected the obesity rate among children?
Well, the obesity rate among children is obviously a huge variable, and it's going to depend on what age group, what state, what race, ethnicity of the child. I mean, there's so many things that predict your risk of obesity. But what has been coming out in the national data is that things seem to be leveling off. So for a very long time, we just were seeing this steep upward climb of childhood obesity rates getting higher and higher and higher. And now it feels like they're flattening out, and particularly among the youngest children, there seems to be some improvement that is, frankly, as someone in this field, is, you know, really nice to see that all of these efforts, I think, are starting to pay off.
Well, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 87% of Americans don't eat enough vegetables, 76% don't get enough fruit. You know, if you're going home and parents don't change their habits, what does this mean for the odds of success overall for the kids?
Well, I think that our whole culture has to shift, and I think that this is happening places other than schools. So, for example, fast food restaurants that have kids' meals over the last, you know, 6 or 7 years, a lot of them have started introducing options to French fries, have started introducing options to soda. So you're now having things like milk as a drink and maybe apple slices or a clementine as the side. And so those will help, but you're right. It's turning around a giant, you know, ship trying to change the overall eating habits of the entire country. And I think that that is going to take time.
We've got an email from Nash who says, I live in central New Jersey and have an app that allows me to monitor what my daughters purchase for lunch every day. Very surprised that chips, cookies, and ice cream are available every day. So there are still some snacky foods there for kids to choose.
Yeah, so I know. And the problem is, as I was mentioning, the industry reformulation, the industry has successfully reformulated chips, cookies, and ice cream. So, yes, they are still chips, cookies, and ice cream, but they're not the same chips, cookies, and ice cream that we had years ago. So they are lower fat. They are going to have less sugar in them. So even though it's not, you know, carrots and hummus or something you might think is a healthier snack, it definitely is an improvement over what was there before.
All right. We've begun the hour talking about the importance of healthy school lunches. We're chatting with Marlene Schwartz, director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at the University of Connecticut. We'll be joined by Justin Gallagher, professor of economics at Case Western Reserve University, after the break for a few more minutes on this topic. So stay with us here on Radio Times. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We're focusing on school lunches for the first half of the hour. Today, the Trump administration is rolling back some Obama-era healthy school lunch requirements, loosening some rules around whole grains and sodium and milk. We've been talking to Marlene Schwartz, director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at the University of Connecticut. And joining us now as well, Justin Gallagher, assistant professor of economics at the Weatherhead School of Management, Case Western Reserve University. Justin is also a co-author of a working paper on school lunch quality and academic performance. Welcome to Radio Times, Justin.
Hi, Mary. Thank you for having me.
So, and again, of course, we've got Marlene Schwartz on board as well. First to you, Justin, according to the research you've done, there is evidence that a healthful lunch given regularly can lead to better test scores?
That's correct. Yeah, so my co-authors and I on the recent study, the reason that we conducted the study was we felt there was an important piece of the discussion missing. We began the work a few years ago when the new Obama-era regulations were being rolled out, and what we saw in the media and among policymakers was that the discussion focused pretty much solely on the health impacts or potential health impacts of the improved food. And we actually thought that there was an overlooked piece, which was a direct impact on learning by students at schools that would now be eating the more healthy food. So to try to answer this question, we conducted our own study. We looked at 5 years of test score data for every single public school student in the state of California from academic year 2008-09 to academic year 2012-13, and linked those end-of-the-year proficiency test scores up with the quality of the food that was being offered in each school during the year. And what we found was a somewhat modest, but very statistically significant, and we argue economically important, increase in test scores for those students in those schools during the years that they were offered healthier school lunches.
How much of an increase?
What we saw, in the study and in many of these education studies, the score outcomes are measured in standard deviation test score increases, and those can be a little bit hard to interpret. One way to think about it is if you're a student at the 50th percentile, sort of the average student at the school, and you were offered a healthier lunch, modestly healthier lunches, I should add, that would be predicted to shift your test score up to about, in a way, so that at the end of the school year, you'd be at the 51.5 percentile. So a relatively modest shift, but we think it's important for a couple of reasons. First, if we take, for example, SAT scores, it could easily be the case that a shift of a couple of percentage points in the distribution would allow a student to be accepted to a school of their choice or pass the threshold for merit scholarships at the school. And second, the cost effectiveness of the program we found to be as cost effective as any other educational policy that we're aware of.
Well, I wanted to get into that next. So how does this compare? How does improving the quality of your lunches compare to other methods to increase test scores, like smaller classes, say? Do you have dollar figures that
we
you
do.
Can give us?
Yeah, so it's been clearly established that teachers are the most important factor in student learning, not surprisingly. And so if we look at the absolute effect of, say, decreasing the size of a classroom by hiring more teachers and having more personalized attention, that the absolute effect size as measured by an improvement in test scores is several times larger than what we observe in our study when we improve the healthfulness of food. However, that said, the cost of hiring a new teacher is many, many times larger than the cost of a slight improvement in the healthfulness of the school lunches. So if we sort of normalize this and look at how many dollars need to be spent to sort of nudge up test scores on sort of a marginal cost effectiveness basis, we find that it's about several times more expensive to do to hire another teacher.
Marlene Schwartz, we only have a few minutes remaining. I did want to take a quick look at lunch shaming. Quite often, poor parents simply don't have the money to pay for meals for their children at school. And this is significant because I know, Justin, I think in your research, you found that test score increases are about 40% larger for students who qualify for reduced price or free school lunches.
That's right.
So what is the effect on children when parents can't pay for these meals? What happens quite often in school?
Well, in theory, if the parents can't pay for the school meals, they could qualify for free or reduced lunches. So hopefully every school district in the country is ensuring that every child whose family qualifies for those benefits is getting them. But it is possible that a child who qualifies, somehow the paperwork hasn't gotten done. And I think it does put the child at risk in terms of not being able to pay for their lunch. I know there were some sort of media accounts of shaming. I personally imagine that it's not terribly common. Certainly in the work I've done with food service directors all over the country, they are deeply devoted to the children. They want to take care of the children and feed them. So the idea of them shaming children, while it certainly sounds like it has happened and there's some bad apples out there, is not, I don't think, the norm. But I think the reaction in terms of legislation to, you know, really take on this issue and for districts to figure out what are they going to do with those unpaid lunch bills is worth, you know, is worth taking a look at and coming up with a solution that doesn't involve shaming the child.
Justin, overall, what do you think of the changes proposed by the Trump administration to tweak the Obama-era healthy lunch regulations?
Sure. Well, I, one of the arguments that I saw discussing slowing down the changes or rolling back some of the changes is the worry that students might not like the new school lunches and therefore might not eat them or purchase them. And this would be particularly troubling for those students who are underserved and the ones that we would most want to eat the lunches via the reduced or free school lunch program. We actually looked at this. And so in our study, what we found is there's no in California during this five-year period, and this was relative to increasing school lunch quality, not through the federal regulation, but through sort of school-by-school basis, we found no change in the number of lunches that were purchased when schools switched from a slightly less healthy lunch to a slightly more healthy lunch. So with that in mind, we feel that sort of the potential drawback that's been emphasized of kind of ratcheting up the quality of the school lunches might not be as much of a concern as some have emphasized.
Now, I'd heard about food waste, too. Marlene, we've got about 30 seconds left. Throw that to you. Has that been an issue?
Well, we did do a study looking specifically at food waste before and after the changes to the school lunches, and we found no increase in the percent of food that was getting thrown away. Now, the caveat is that a lot of food does get thrown away in the school lunch, but it's always been the case. It has not gotten worse with the healthier lunches.
All right, Marlene Schwartz, thank you so much for the insight, for joining us here on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Marlene is head of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at the University of Connecticut. And Justin Gallagher, great to have you along as well.
Thank you.
Justin is an assistant professor at Case Western Reserve University and an author of a paper on school lunch quality and academic performance. So, turning our attention now to teenagers and sleep and school. If you've ever had to drag a groggy adolescent out of bed to make the 6:50 a.m. bus, you know what a challenge this can be. And perhaps you've wondered exactly how much education this teen would actually absorb before 10 or 11 in the morning. Well, research has shown that in general, adolescents are simply wired differently than the rest of us. They aren't ready to go to sleep until late in the evening, but they still need a good 8 to 10 hours a night or they risk negative health and safety effects. And now a study from the RAND Corporation has found that starting class too early for this group could be costing the country billions. Lines are open if you'd like to weigh in. 888-477-9499. Again, you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Joining us now, Wendy Troxell is co-author of the study, the RAND study, and a senior behavioral and social scientist at the RAND Corporation. Also an adjunct professor of psychiatry and psychology at the University of Pittsburgh. Hi, Wendy.
Hello.
And Amy Noor is a parent and a parent of three children in the Lower Merion School District. Her youngest is currently a senior at Harrington High School. She's a member of the Regional Adolescent Sleep Needs Coalition, and Amy is also a member of the WHYY Community Advisory Board. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you for having me.
So, Amy, first to you, you'd co-signed an opinion letter to the Mainline Times earlier this summer, a letter which quotes some students from Harrington and Lower Merion High Schools who'd taken a sleep survey. And I'd like to just read some of the quotes. "My mind does not function at 7:30 in the morning. I am in a constant state of sleep deprivation." Another quote, "I feel miserable most of the time. I get grueling headaches. I feel sort of sick most days." And finally, "Lack of sleep makes every single task twice as difficult and eats away at my energy, effort, and motivation." So let's back up a bit. What prompted the sleep survey in the first place?
Okay. In early 2014, the parent group of which I was co-president brought Judith Owens, who's a national leading pediatric sleep researcher, to Lower Merion to speak to our district parents and administrators. We had about 300 people. After that program, other districts became interested, and we formed a regional sleep coalition. At the same time, Lower Merion parents, with the permission of the school board president and the superintendent, did a several-month study interviewing about 25 administrators to see what the problems were in our district with lack of sleep and also with what any logistical issues we might encounter with moving high school to a later start time.
What did you find with lack of sleep? What was found? Some of the issues?
Well, really everything that also Wendy will talk about in the research, but they are not focused at 7:30 in the morning going to class. It's harder to learn those first couple of hours. They are more prone to emotional issues, the stress, depression, suicidal ideation, more prone to eating disorders, substance abuse. And as Judith Owens says, which is one of my favorite quotes, it takes a sleepy student 5 hours to do 3 hours of homework.
Yeah. I can attest to that. Wendy Traxel, again, experts recommend that teens get an average of 8 to 10 hours of sleep a night. What are they really getting?
Yeah, well, what we know is that there is really an epidemic of teens' sleep deprivation. Less than a third of American teens, and that's probably a optimistic estimate, are actually getting so at least the minimum of 8 hours of sleep per night, and many are getting far fewer. And as Amy said, that's hurting their academic functioning, their mental health, and their physical health. And it can really set the stage for long-term risk, because many of the issues that present during adolescence, such as substance use problems or mood disorders, they really skyrocket in adolescence. So it's a vulnerable period, but it sets the trajectory for, for future life into adulthood. So it's really a critical tipping point.
Wendy, there's been a lot of talk in recent years about, starting class later for adolescents. And the RAND Corporation has done an extensive study on what the economic benefits might be if the U.S. mandated that public schools begin the school day no earlier than 8:30 in the morning. What did the study find?
Sure. And again, we conducted the study on the heels of the consistent and robust science over the past 30 years showing the tremendous public health benefits of later school start times. But what we wanted to do was consider the economic benefits. And so what we did was we looked at the economic impact of a nationwide shift in school start times to 8:30 a.m. or later from U.S. middle and high schools. And by the way, 8:30 a.m. is the time that's recommended by major medical organizations such as the American Academy of Pediatrics. What we found was that such a move to a healthy start time for adolescents could contribute up to $83 billion to the U.S. economy over a decade span.
And what are the sources for all this extra, this extra infusion of money into the economy? Are we talking about, fewer car accidents, so fewer injured children, or worse? Are we talking about greater academic performance? What are we talking about here?
Exactly. You've named two of our primary factors. These economic projections that we did in our study would be realized through the higher academic and professional performance of students, so their potential for lifetime earnings, which has a big impact on the economy, as well as a reduction in car crash rates among adolescents. And we know that drowsy driving among adolescents is a major risk factor. And in fact, car crashes are the number one cause of mortality among teens. This is not only tremendous, the worst tragedy one can imagine as a parent, but it also has an impact on the future labor supply of the economy. That's how economists would talk about this.
I'll just follow up.
Those are the two primary factors we considered.
Well, just this note from AAA, which did a study finding that over the past 5 years, a quarter of the 16 to 18-year-olds who were driving were at some point so tired they had a hard time keeping their eyes open. That's a quarter of that population. So, but, you know, switching again, it is. It's just scary. Switching again, though, to these later start times, easier said than done. And I'd like to bring a caller into the conversation, Rebecca in Wilmington, because there, you know, sometimes it's not always easy for parents. So welcome, Rebecca, to Radio Times.
Hi, yes. My comment was that I saw this change in my nephew's school district in Colorado. They changed it, and what they didn't think about, I don't think, was that there are a lot of families, especially in middle income and lower income, who depend on older siblings to watch younger siblings for an hour, 2 hours in the afternoon in order to get home from work and not have to pay the very expensive after school costs. And so now they have kids second grade, third grade, just going home alone to empty homes.
All right. Thank you for the call to a Radio Times, Rebecca. We, you know, Amy Noor, we do have these issues. You've got you changing family dynamics. Also, hugely, is you've got to change the bus schedules. And that's probably one of the biggest, you know, it hits school districts in the pocketbook. Could you tell us a little bit about what the discussion is like in the Lower Merion District regarding that issue? Or have you had that discussion even begun?
Well, a couple of things. I would contend that it doesn't necessarily, you can't assume that it costs more to switch the bus schedule if, for example, you flipped, let's say, typically in our district and many surrounding districts, high school starts at 7:30, middle school starts at 8:15, and elementary school starts at 9 a.m. If you were, let's say, to flip elementary and high school, you may not need an increased number of buses. So a study would need to be done to see what each district would need, but you would need an increased number of buses if all three levels started at 9 a.m., but no district is proposing that.
All right. I'm sorry. We're up against a break, so hold that thought. We're going to get to that in just a moment. We're talking about the early school start times, drowsy teenagers, and the effects, and also not only the health effects and safety effects, the economic effects as well. Amy Noor is a parent of children in the Lower Merion School District, and also Wendy Troxell is a senior behavioral and social scientist at the RAND Corporation. RAND has done a study on this issue, and we'll have more for you in just a bit on Radio Times. Stay with us. This is WHYY in Philadelphia, and you are listening to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings. Jordan Marty has the day off, and for the remainder of the hour, we are taking a look at classroom times, the beginning of the school day for middle school and high schoolers, and whether those times should be pushed back to 8:30, maybe even 9 o'clock in the morning, what the benefits would be, and also the challenges inherent in making the switch for many school districts. We are joined by Amy Noor, parent of three children in the Lower Merion School District. Her youngest is a senior at Harridan High School. Amy is a member of the Regional Adolescent Sleep Needs Coalition. And Wendy Troxell is an adjunct professor of psychiatry and psychology at the University of Pittsburgh and a co-author of a new study from the RAND Corporation looking at the economic impact of later school start times. We're getting into one of the thorniest issues facing districts who might want to make the switch, and that is the bus schedule. And Amy, you were talking about the fact that it might not be as difficult as others perhaps think it is to flip schedules.
I think it's complicated. What I was saying is I'm not sure what the cost implication is, and that's okay for each district to look at. But the complication, at least in districts around our region, is that we bus not only to our own school public schools, but we bus to all independent and parochial schools within a 10-mile radius of students in our district. So, for example, for Lower Merion, it has 10 public schools, but buses to over 100 schools every day. That makes it complicated logistically to switch, particularly with a three-tiered busing system.
Wendy, what happens if you switch the times for young kids and older kids? Are the young kids affected by going earlier?
Sure, yeah, and to sort of comment on the caller's comment as well, which I think is a really good point, it brings up the fact that changing school start times does affect the entire community. Now, I can go on and on about the substantial research showing the tremendous benefits of later start times for adolescents. And it's it's really striking. I mean, and there's, you know, it's unequivocal. So we need to start from there. But we also need to recognize that there are logistical challenges. And one of them is the impact on younger students. There are many ways to implement later start times. As Amy mentioned, many school districts go about a later start time shift by flipping elementary with the upper grades, which makes sense from a biological standpoint. Because, again, the reason this is an issue for adolescents is because that their sleep-wake biology is simply different than younger students or adults. So
they want, they feel more, the melatonin starts to kick in, what, at 11 at night? Is that the way it works?
Around 11 p.m. at night. So it's about a 2 to 3 hour shift in the time when their bodies are biologically able to sleep. So, you know, you'll often hear naysayers say, well, just put them to bed earlier. You can put them in bed, but they are not going to sleep. It's sort of like if you experience jet lag. If you're on an earlier time zone and you try to go to bed at a time that's not consistent with your biological rhythm, you may try really hard, but your brain is not ready to sleep because the melatonin hasn't been released yet. That's what happens to teenagers. This is not a willful situation that we can just force them to bed.
Sure.
Well, so the challenges of they do affect the entire community, including younger children, and often concerns are raised about younger children at bus stops in the early hours. And I agree that's a legitimate concern, but these are problems to be solved. For instance, increased lighting at bus stops or having a volunteer parent at an elementary school bus stop, which, by the way, is much more likely to occur than having a parent at a bus stop for middle or high school students. So once you look at the public health significance of this issue and now the economic benefits as well of healthy start times, you kind of have to look at these logistical challenges as they are. They are problems to be solved, and it does take community engagement and some amount of time, but not forever, mm-hmm. because there are examples from districts around the country who have successfully done this. So it's time that districts start drawing from the resources that are out there and learn creative solutions to these challenges that they face.
All right, we've struck a nerve with this topic. Lots of calls and comments coming in, so let's get to some of them. We've got an email from Tib who says, as for students with after-school jobs, wouldn't this also just move their job hours to later in the day? Why don't we just assign curfews to their phones, computers, and televisions? So there are two things at work here. We've got digital devices, which we've done a number of shows on this. They interrupt with the sleep cycle. It's the blue light. Correct? Wendy, you want to comment on that?
That is correct.
And
suppress the hormone melatonin.
And so making it more difficult to sleep. But the other piece of it is kids have activities. They've got not only sports or theater or what have you at school, but then they've also got after-school jobs. So everything just shifts later. In your experience, I mean, you've got your mom of three, Amy Noor, and I'm assuming your kids are probably pretty active in going
yes.
through school. You know, if everything shifts later, doesn't homework get shifted later as well?
Yes, everything. Let's say we started school an hour later. Everything would get shifted an hour later, but the kids go to school ready to learn, ready to participate, functioning better physically and mentally. So when they get to the homework later, they're better able to do it in a more expeditious fashion. And in terms of activities, sports is a big one. Well-rested students and athletes have fewer sports injuries and perform better on the field.
So I guess, though, but then if you have a lot to do, are you getting to bed by 11 p.m., which is the ideal time to aim for if you're going to get those 8 to 10 hours?
Well, I'll go back again to that Judy Owens quote. You're going to reduce your homework time because you're well-rested.
Ah.
So you're not going to be staying up later doing the homework if you've gotten adequate sleep to begin with.
Okay, to the phones we go. Rick in New Hope, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, thanks, Mary.
Sure. So what
I'm
is... go ahead.
Sorry. I'm the director of studies at Solbury School in New Hope, Pennsylvania, and we change to a later start time schedule starting in the 2016 school year. We're in our second year of doing it, and wanted to call in and let you know that our experience with it has been excellent, mostly positive results. There always will be challenges with the transportation, as you mentioned, but we definitely would do it all again and see great upside to making the change.
So tell me just a little bit about some of the positives. Are you seeing students walk in with a little bit more bounce in their step? Happier to be there, more productive, test scores, or is it too early because you've only done this for 1 year?
Yeah, well, we waited till the year was well on its way last year, and in the wintertime, January, February, I collected some hard data from students, and the soft data was very favorable just in terms of their opinions. Over 90% were either neutral or favorable to it. And then by the end of the year, the grades came in, and they were great. We had less students reporting, you know, high levels of stress and anxiety, and our grades were consistent, if not higher, than they've been in the past.
So what are the challenges that remain, Rick?
Well, the challenge is every year we're going to look to refine it and make it a little bit better, and there always will be transportation challenges for us. You know, Solbury School offers breakfast every morning, and so for those parents and families who can't really utilize the 8:30 start time for sleep, they can use it to get to school at the time they might have done in the past, say 10 to 8, and they can get breakfast. And so then we know our students will be ready to go for classes that way as well. So we try to mitigate any of the downside of it with looking for positive ways to help our students. If it's not sleep, then there are other ways. In addition, we've found ways to reduce the homework load. So tying in with your last question, that our students still get the homework done that they need to get done, but it's been reduced from, you know, 5 or 6 classes a night down to 2 or 3, and that's also helped with their stress levels.
So you are staying the course.
Absolutely. We're staying the course, making it better every year, and we love it. The teachers love it, and so do the students.
All right. Thanks for the call to Radio Times.
Thank you.
All right. We also have this email from Jill, and this kind of ties in. Maybe the issues are more about kids being overwhelmed with work and activities, and they're up too late to finish their schoolwork. Wendy, does this play into this at all?
Absolutely. Now, think about yourself, how you feel when you're sleep-deprived. Just the activities of daily living become overwhelming. You know, it's just that much harder to cope when you're not well slept. And teens of today do face a lot of stress. And, you know, whether it's the highest achieving kids or the kids that are struggling in school, they're facing a lot of stress. And we're seeing that manifest in skyrocketing rates of mental health issues, including depression, anxiety, substance use, and suicide, the things that terrify us as parents. We also know that sleep directly contributes to those risks. So if we want to promote the health and the whole child, we need to protect their sleep. And this is one population-level strategy to do so. We can also do great individual-level interventions, including reminding parents to get the technology out of the bedroom. But that can only do so much. We've got to do public health policy-level interventions to treat such a policy-level and population-level epidemic.
Then there's the social, societal cachet of being a person who needs less sleep. A few years back, sleep expert Judith Owen said it's still a badge of honor to get 5 hours of sleep. Amy Noor, do you encounter this in your life?
I hear that.
Yeah. Are you pretty strict about requirements? You know, you got to get your sleep in your household?
I do the best I can. Yeah. But my kids never got more than 7 hours of sleep, which already puts them at a 2-hour sleep debt per night. The one thing I do that with my third child that I didn't do before because I didn't realize it is she's not permitted to drive if she doesn't have 8.5 hours of sleep because I know the risks. But I don't think most parents are even aware of that.
Yeah. Wendy, weigh in on that if you would.
The risks of drowsy driving?
Well, no, well the societal attitude of, you know, I get five hours of sleep and I am a super person and look at all that I'm accomplishing. Is that changing at all? Are we starting to see a shift in cultural attitude?
Well, to some extent, yes. As the research on the health consequences of sleep loss become more and more widely disseminated, I think that there is somewhat of a shift. But the truth is, we do still live in a society where, you know, sleep loss is sort of a badge of honor. And we hear this sort of around the water cooler, people bragging about how they can get by on a few hours of sleep. The truth of the matter is, we know from sleep science that less than 2% of the population are what's called natural short sleepers, meaning that they can kind of get away with sleeping less than what's recommended for their age group. And we also see this attitude, you know, shifted towards our teenagers when we hear things like we're coddling our teenagers by trying to support healthy start time policy. That is consistent with this badge of honor for sleep deprivation kind of attitude. And we really need to change that attitude because it's simply not supported by the science.
Well, I know with one of mine who's no longer in high school, it was a battle to try to get this particular child to get enough sleep. And I was told, well, I feel fine. I don't need any more sleep. I'm okay. And the average is probably about 6 hours. You know, what's the best way to approach that conversation, Amy? What are your thoughts as a parent? I struggled with it.
It's difficult. I mean, I do think the cell phone needs to be out of the room. The experts say do not let your child use the cell phone as the alarm. I think they should be off social media, a lot more than they are, but certainly 30 to 60 minutes before bed. They should not be on those phones because of the blue light. But honestly, without changing start times, there's only so much you can do as a parent when they're getting up at 6 a.m. for the 6:50 bus. And it's a real struggle. I know a lot of students from our survey take naps after school. They sleep in late on the weekends, which I think is not recommended within the medical community. But Wendy could better address that in terms of making up the sleep debt.
Catching up, Wendy. What do you think?
Yes, we basically have this phenomenon known as social jet lag among our teenagers, because basically every week during the school week, they're sleep deprived and they're sleeping at a time that's misaligned with their biological rhythms. Again, just like jet lag, if you go to shift time zones. And then on the weekend, their bodies revert back to their natural biological rhythms. And as a parent, you can kind of really understand, I struggle with this as a parent and a sleep researcher, that I know my child is deprived of sleep during the week, but I also know the consequences of erratic sleep schedules and that switching back and forth. So I'm constantly battling in my own home, do I let him catch up on that sleep debt on the weekend? Or do I mind the research which shows that actually that weekend, what we call oversleep, is actually also associated with health consequences? We get back to, we need policy to support teens getting adequate sleep during the week so that their 7-day week sleep schedule can be roughly consistent instead of this flip-flop between sleep deprivation, oversleep, then Sunday night comes around, and talk about the battles you're going to have.
Oh, sure.
When you try to put a teen to bed after they've slept in the morning on their natural schedule, and then you try to force them to bed too early. Again, you're trying to force their bodies kind of in an unwinnable fight.
So, and again, we've been talking about an awful lot of positives toward making the switch, but it's relatively few districts across the country have actually done this despite the evidence. Amy Knorr, the Unionville Chads Ford School District, has made the step. This was
just made the step for this September. They're the first public school district in our area. Solbury School also did their an independent school. So they just started this September. It was a 3-year process, and it started by students coming to the school board to advocate for this.
So students actually help affect the change.
They did in Unionville Chadsford. I think they're a critical component of any change, they and the parents. And what I think is really important is to educate the community, because a lot of parents really are not aware of a lot of the research, although it's becoming more and more prominent, and then to advocate within your local community.
Again, Wendy Troxell, relatively few districts doing this. Where do you see this going across the country? Do you see it catching on, the later start times?
Yeah, we do see an increased momentum and an increased recognition of the research, but still less than 20% of school districts across the country have start times for middle and high school at 8:30 a.m. or later at this point. So we've got a long way to go, and it's these logistical challenges that come up in district after district around the country. And we really need to find a way to pool the resources that are already out there to learn from the success story.
Yeah, I'm going to have to stop you there. Unfortunately, we are unfortunately out of time, Wendy. It was a great half hour. Wendy Trexel, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Senior behavior and social scientist at RAND, and Amy Noor, pleasure as well.
Pleasure for me. Thank
you. Parent and activist in the Lower Merion School District. Our engineer today, Diana Martinez, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, Tornay Nuri, our producers.